You're listening to the Good Food for Glasgow podcast. This episode features interviews with play worker Alistair McCall and researcher Beth Cloughton from Baltic Street Adventure Playground, as well as Jack from the Wash House Garden. These are full-length versions of interviews conducted as part of a Good Food Trail of Glasgow's East End for Glasgow Doors Open Day. You can listen and walk along with the trail on the platform Guidego, linked in the podcast description. Or if you prefer to listen to a podcast version, here you are. This episode is part one, and you can listen to the other stops on the tour, at Green City Whole Foods and Celentano's, in part two. We're at Baltic Street Adventure Playground, and I'm joined by Beth and Alistair from Baltic Street Adventure Playground. First of all, if you could just introduce yourselves and explain what you do here.
Hi, I'm Beth, and I'm a researcher at Baltic Street in a project between the University of Glasgow and Baltic Street Adventure Playground. I mainly focus on the food hub that we have, and I've been here for nearly 4 years.
Hi, my name's Alistair. I'm a play worker with responsibility for food at Baltic Street Adventure Playground. I've been here for 7 years, so everything in relation to food is down to me.
This is where the kids will have the food, and then in the winter we can put this fire on, and then it's like really nice when it rains especially to like have all the kids in here just playing about. In the summer it's lots of play, lots of running and tumbling, and then these sculptures are what kids have made as well. A lot of it is like through found objects or through donations from anyone and everyone who wants to donate. Usually when you come in, like week to week, there's some kind of new feature. The whole ethos of it is that children can ascertain how risky they want to play, and essentially like kind of one of the only rules is if you go up somewhere you need to be able to know how to get down. It's also a playground to come to. It's also been established by the play workers of Baltic Street, and then we had to have this little sculpture being built because we had some foxes. Cultivated by two of the mums whose children come here, and they just knew this technique to grow them, so they'd like built these wooden structures because it encourages the peas to just climb basically.
For people that have never heard of Baltic Street Adventure Playground, to give a bit of an outline of what you do, and maybe Alistair, you could go into some of the history of the space.
The area that you're in is in the top 5% of the Scottish Index of Multiple Deprivation. So financial, social, food insecurity is a big issue for families here. When the Commonwealth Games came to Dumbarnock, Celtic Park in particular, everything here went. All the amenities, the sports centre, the community centre, the playground, all the shops, all the social housing, everything went. There was a promise of regeneration, but unfortunately that's been very slow in coming. You fast forward 10 years, there's still no local shop here. The playground itself is the only green space in the location, and it's an area that was developed through money that was made available through the Commonwealth Committee. And initially it was to engage an art project that would engage a community. That was expected to last 2 years. We're in our tenth. So it's divided into three parts. The play element, which is primarily primary school children, so ages 5 to 12. We've recently started an outdoor nursery, fully outdoors, which is for 3 to 5 year olds. And then you have the food aspect, which is a non-referral free food hub that we operate. So everything we do here is free. It's an area for children to be children, to run, climb, jump, explore their own curiosity, to risk assess for themselves, team build, and all these social skills that we want to encourage. That, by extension, in the nursery is the spirit of the nursery as well. When the children are here, they're all fed a hot meal. So during term time, if you take the 5 to 12 year olds, we average up to about 50 children a day. Those numbers swell in the summer holidays up to nearly 500 a day, and they're all fed every food intolerance, dietary requirement, everything, we meet that, because the whole spirit of the playground here is about inclusion rather than exclusion. So children are coming here with the expectation of being fed. So we don't want anyone to come in the gate and say, well, there's nothing for me to eat. Because if you look at the energy that these children are burning up, that's a great equaliser, regardless of where you come from in the social spectrum, that food brings people together. And without it, obviously, we're not going to survive. And particularly, a lot of these children won't be receiving a meal at home. So it might be the only food that that child has. During the school holidays, equally it's important because a lot of them won't be accessing free school meals. So we fill that void.
With the food hub, the amount of times that people have said that this is like an urban oasis is such an indicative metaphor of like what the area is like and what the area could be, because it's one of the UK's most intense food deserts. And I know there's some problems around calling places food deserts, but as Alistair said, the only place to get food, I guess, from like a mainstream marketplace is the garage across the road. And the road, or the coach car park, used to be a green space. And a lot of what Glasgow City Council and Scottish Government have been saying about the area since the Commonwealth Games is that it's going to be sustainable, it's going to be flourishing. And that can't happen without long-term adequate funding. And Baltic Street is this amazing place that has been created by locals for local people. And like what we're saying with the coach car park that you'll have come across on your way here, that was called an Accord Centre, which is for adults with disabilities and their carers. There was also some other local resource centres, green space, and that was destroyed for an event from like a month for coaches. And it's just that kind of discrepancy between like the consultations. People in this area have been over consulted as to what they want. They want a shop that's like accessible both in cost and in your ability to get to it easily, because there's such a wide range of people that live in the area that lots of different accessibility needs have to be addressed. And for example, in this area, children are 58% more likely to experience poverty. And this is state-led austerity measures. This is like a state-led consequence. And Baltic Street just offers this form of relief. And although the food hub is addressing food insecurity needs, it shouldn't be this long-term solution. It should be this place where people can come and try and experiment. It's like very joyous. And it is joyful, like the work we do with the community garden and with the children. But the fact that in, I think it was 2016 or 17, there was like a £15 million expansion of the charitable food model rather than investing in adequate welfare and social security. It's actually profit motivated overstocking that enables food charities to exist. And like the work that people do in food charities is incredible, but it essentially allows the rolling back of the welfare state.
You're touching on so many things that I feel like come up time and time again in this sort of sector of you can have so much joy and connection. And I think it was really interesting what Alistair was saying around people are burning so much energy here, the kids are running around so much that it makes sense that they need a meal afterwards. I'm sure there's so much enjoyment that they will get from eating together, and that must be a really special aspect. But those things are things that you want to be able to do out of joy and for the joy of the community and the people that are there, and not out of necessity, because as you say, there's this willful austerity and that basic things just aren't being provided.
Even with the way that we index people who experience insecurity and poverty, the way in which it's indexed, so here Delmonic ranks in the first most deprived decile, except for two, but also the indexification doesn't allow for maybe like state-led crimes or state-led measures in terms of potentially excessive police violence. And so even the way in which like people are indexed as like deprived or in poverty, I also think can conceal quite a lot.
So as we're kind of finishing the summer holidays now, you're back to term time and maybe slightly calmer times. What does a typical summer's day look like at Baltic Street Adventure Playground?
Well, the first thing I would say, there isn't a typical day at Baltic Street. Every day is completely different. Every day is wacky. You can't predict what's going to happen. People will say, oh, but the weather. The weather doesn't affect it. We still get kids coming in here, jumping in puddles, getting soaked. Gala day at the end of it there was quite wet. Later on in the afternoon, we had a massive water fight, and then the kids went out and they were breakdancing in puddles out in the street. So there isn't a typical day in terms of the fun and the events. That's the true spirit of this playground. The children own the space. It's democratically run. So they come here, they do what they want to do, unless it's dangerous or it's unacceptable behaviour. Go and explore your own curiosity, play with what you can find. So there's no set routine. We do have workshops, not so much in the summer because it's too busy, but during term time we've got every hand tool you can imagine. So the kids learn to use hammers and saws and drills and all that kind of thing, and learn that their tools are not weapons. This area used to be rife with violence. So you've got that soft intervention where children are actually learning the use of tools for proper and valid reasons. With fire pits, they learn how to light fire with flint and cotton wool and Vaseline. We've got all the animals here, the absolute menagerie out there. So they learn to take care of the animals, tend them, and they learn about the life cycle and all that educational aspect. So as you see, we've got chickens, ducks, rabbits, guinea pigs, we've got two reptile enclosures. It just seems to grow and grow. We've got gerbils and all sorts. So the children are learning in the morning, for example, today, the nursery kids were in. They collected the eggs and having scrambled egg for their breakfast. So they're learning about these basic life skills that perhaps in areas like this, children don't get exposed to these things. We've the raised beds, we've a polytunnel, so we grow our own produce. So you see kids picking carrots straight out of the ground and eating them. We've got strawberries, we've got fruit trees. So these are all things that this little green space in the middle of what's a brown field site now is really giving these children some life experience in a healthy and a cultured way. So the good thing is, although there's that educational part, there's the social interaction, a lot of it is spontaneous and child-led. So it's not like today we are going to do this, because generally they say, well, we don't want to do that, but we want to do this, so that's fine. You know, let them take the lead. And particularly when they're younger, they're like wee sponges. They take it all in. In terms of food, summer, where they even begin. You know, I've been here a long time now, and the numbers when I started weren't anything like they are now. So I've grown with that, and you learn to adapt. Just now our kitchen's no larger than a domestic kitchen that you would find at home. Up until COVID, it was half the size. So we're cooking on top of fridges and all sorts. You know, it's just, you adapt to make do and learn how to economise the time and all these elements, because the food, every single day, it goes out at 1:30 without fail. And that is a big task, but it's a team effort and we all just go on with it. You see here, the queue will be from where the kitchen is all the way down through the playground and past where we're sitting just now. So it's a sight to see. You know, we're providing 7-8 different dishes every single day. In this area, the demographics have changed in the last 4 or 5 years. But before that, it was very much white, indigenous, Glaswegian families who 4 or 5 generations, and not a lot had changed. And with that, people are creatures of habit to a certain extent. So growing up, kids in this area would have mince and totties on a Monday, stovies on a Tuesday. And to deviate from that is very difficult when that's all they're used to. And we've spoken in the past about when we started to develop the food hub, that was just by extension an extra service. We're not funded to do that. And it was a way of supporting families with surplus food that we had, you know, helping them if it's maybe 2 meals a week that they're not having to fund. That can be a big bonus for families. But with that, when we were sourcing food through Fair Share, we used to talk about the butternut squash syndrome. And remember way back at the beginning, I get this crate of butternut squash and saying to parents, do you want this? No, I don't eat that muck. And I go, well, what is it anyway? So when people talk about food insecurity, immediately think about it in financial terms. But quite often it could just be, I don't know what that is and I don't know what to do with it. And as we gradually speak to people, say, well, you could do this, you can do that, and give them some ideas, at least they're not going and buying something they don't know really what it is, what to do with it. You know, you get that for nothing. Go and try it. If you like it, it's a bonus. If you don't, well, at least you've tried it and you say you don't like it. So the project here, although we promote good health, that's about being outdoors and exercising and all these kind of things. In terms of food, there has to be a sense of reality that, you know, we can't force a diet on people that allow them to make their own choices, because primarily it's about ensuring these kids have food in their belly, but try to do that as sensibly as we can. There has to be a sense of pragmatism with it. So through the meals that we do, we gradually introduce some veg and some healthier options, so it allows them to try that. And we see the kids coming now, though, 3-4 different dishes. So it's that drip feeding a healthier diet, but not saying, here's a bowl of salad, with all due respect, here's a bowl of salad, you're going to eat it, because they'll just go, I'm not going to eat that, out of defiance. Whereas they see the produce being grown, they understand where it comes from, they help harvest that. So even if they're having a burger with a lettuce leaf that they've picked out of the garden, it's a step forward. And that's really what we're trying to do.
When you're talking about with the garden and the plate, the ambience of it is very gradual learning. And I think as well, the space is so well trusted because of its longevity here, which is something that I don't think is common in areas which are like, oh, you can have this like temporary funding for this like short-term thing. The like level of trust that has been developed between Baltic Street and the community allows people, I think, to be more experimental or adventurous when they come into the space. So like during the feeding of the 10,000 in summers, because there's so many different options and because it's not bureaucratic, like where you can have one of this and like a side dish, I think people are much more open to like have their burger and then like maybe try a vegan risotto on the side, and it's much more playful and less serious. And I think it is through that informality and the trust that is engendered here that allows people to be maybe more risky with their food and like riskier with their play, because we're so well trusted.
To add on to that, when COVID came, now we mark time in terms of when COVID arrived, it's, unfortunately. You think, wow, that's 3.5 years ago since that took place. But in terms of the food hub, that was a huge shift change for us, because prior to that, we would have probably about upwards of towards 100 families would access the surplus food every week. And that's families, not individuals. So you multiply that by an average family. So you say anywhere up to about 300-400 people were supported by it. When COVID came, the lockdown particularly, we had to stop the play element because of restrictions that were put in place. And for the first fortnight, we just made up food parcels. So we'd spoken about the fact there's no local shop here. With all the restrictions, people couldn't get to supermarkets for lots of different reasons. So the first fortnight, we were just making up food bags. That's all we did. And then realised very quickly that because we're an outdoor facility, we couldn't sustain that because the requests and for support was just overwhelming. Fortunately, we have a good relationship with the Brigton Centre, and we moved in there, so it basically became a supermarket warehouse. And overnight, we went to supporting 500 families twice a week, delivering in our own cars, just constantly making up food parcels. Eventually, when we did come back and restrictions were lifted, those numbers followed us. So now it's steadied off probably about 300 families a week, give or take. And the benefit is that, you know, everything we're trying to do here is about reducing stigma. So people aren't mean-tested, they can turn up here, they can have a chat with staff, and the volunteers that are here, they offload. Because with all these catchphrases or new phrases around COVID, and return to normality is one that's always stuck with me. And what isn't recognised is that the return to normality for people in this locality, it's actually worse than it was before. That is their normality now. And that's sad to say it in today's society, but it's the truth that things are getting harder with all the increase in fuel, the increase in food, and support is less. And with that comes the byproduct. During COVID, we were running 2 full-blown suicide interventions a week. Unfortunately, myself and other colleagues are trained to deal with that. But that's not part of our core function. But these were all the things that came with it. My fridge freezer isn't working. Can you source one for me? I need clothes for the children. All these other things, requests for support, that's very difficult to turn down if we have the facility to support them in doing that. So as Beth says, that has been a huge bonus in terms of our relationship with the community. And we always feel here that this community was decimated, absolutely decimated. And our job isn't to rebuild the community, it's to facilitate and support the community to rebuild itself and become whatever it's going to turn out. And I think a lot of these things combined with demographics are changing now, that we have people from Eastern Europe, we have African families have moved in here, Chinese families, so it's become quite diverse. And that can be very difficult for a community to gel. But we're seeing that now. We have volunteers in here who are from Poland, who have a volunteer coming from Africa. So that's really healthy in terms of the community really rediscovering itself.
I feel like this is an area where history gets done to people and stereotypes are levied at people, but there's such an amazing amount of reciprocity. For example, I've been given like Easter cards and Christmas cards, donations when they knew I was moving flats, or like food. There's just such a reciprocity between the space and with the community that it serves that I feel like often goes under acknowledged, and potentially like especially food donations spaces, just like the huge generosity of the community is great.
In all that you're saying, it's coming out that I feel like Baltic Street Adventure Playground really is responding to a need, and that your flexibility of listening to what people need maybe beyond what your core mission is. If people are listening and they really support what you're doing and they wanted to help out at all, is there anything you'd like to signpost or say, like, this is how you can help out, or food donations?
If you talk about the holiday food programme, for example, during the holidays, we are well supported by, it was the Scottish Government, this year it's been the local authority. So they support us financially to provide meals for children when they're not accessing school meals. Out with that period, all the food that we source in the main is via Fair Share. So we have a membership with Fair Share, and that's the food that we use for the playground, and it also supports the food hub, which is a great way when you look at food waste, for example. The quality of the food that we get from them is exceptional. The only thing is, and it's well documented by Fair Share UK themselves, that for lots of different reasons, the volume of the food is reducing. So it started off with Brexit, and then it was COVID, lack of HGV drivers, the war in Ukraine. This summer, because of the heat in Europe, fruit and veg hasn't been available. So the amount of food that we're getting has been reduced. Now, hopefully in the long term, that won't be a permanent situation, but certainly at the moment it is. And if you couple all that together with rising costs for food manufacturers and distributors, a lot of that surplus, for example, we used to get lots of offcuts of salmon. So we cut the salmon fillets and the tails and the ends would be redistributed through Fairshare. We don't get that now, because the producers are putting them in fish cakes or ready meals or whatever. So the volume that we are getting is reducing. The other thing that we have a dearth of is halal. We used to get halal meat, whereas now we just don't get that at all. Islamic Aid used to contribute, but that's very, very seldom do we access to it. So we don't have the funds to go and buy that. But with families coming here that we're struggling to actually give them food that's appropriate for their diet and religious observance. So things like that, if there was support to be made available, particularly that, is smaller in numbers, but is very important. I mentioned earlier about inclusion. I really get disappointed when we have families who have a halal diet come here and we really don't have an awful lot to give them.
I would say as well, another way people could support Baltic Street is through donations, through cash donations. I think we've got it on our website, QR code. So yeah, anything that could go to the core budget would be great.
Good to let people know that they can if they are able to. I feel like what has really just struck me in everything you've said is, I guess, the safe space that you create for people to try new things, and that for the children, like, because it already is such a democratic child-led space, that then when it comes to the food, it makes it so much more likely that they will feel safe and comfortable to try new things, which I think is so important and great to hear about. But is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think what you say about a safe space is really important to us. In nature, the real survivors are not the fastest or the strongest. It's those that are most adaptable to change. And I think that's one of our real strengths here, that we do adapt all the time to changes and pressures and, you know, things that are not necessarily within our control, but it's how we adapt to it to support the community. I mentioned earlier, this is our 10th year for what was supposed to be a 2-year pop-up project. And I think that's why we've achieved the 10 years and hopefully another 10 years and expand on here, is because we don't sit back and say, right, that's it, we've done our bit now. I think it's always, here's a new challenge, let's grasp it and go on and see what we can do about it. And I think that's the thing that you mention about support from outward. We can't control that. We can say, well, here's our worth, or how we see our worth and the value within the community. But there's loads and loads of other projects the same as ours that are struggling to get that support. So it's how we adapt and just work on our strengths to do what we can.
And I would say, we have such a good group of volunteers that supports our capacity. And I think we've been really lucky with just the commitment of volunteers and their dedication to what this space is about. The Food Hub is primarily run with dedicated volunteers. And that's an amazing part of this as well. Like, again, the reciprocity of the community wanting to help out. So yeah, shout out to the volunteers.
All right, well, thanks very much. Yeah, it was so interesting to hear everything you had to say. So the next stop on our tour is the Wash House Garden. You'll hear that it's situated on quite a busy street. If you come down on a volunteer open day, you'll find the gates open and a little passage down to their amazing market garden tucked away behind some flats. So we'll open the gate and go on in. There's definitely the smell of celery in the air. What are you up to over here?
I'm like taking a couple of stems from each plant and then leaving them so they can regenerate and grow back.
Jack, please could you introduce yourself, say a little about what you do at the Wash House Garden and what the Wash House Garden is, if anyone doesn't know.
Yeah, of course. So my name is Jack and I am one of the directors at the Wash House Garden and one of the head growers here. We are a small market garden with a bit of community garden mixed in, so we're a bit of a hybrid, and we grow fruits and vegetables and herbs on about a fifth of an acre, so it's quite a small site. It's kind of tucked away between some tenement flats, just hidden off the main road in the east end of Glasgow. And we run a veg box scheme, and we also grow a little bit for cafes and restaurants and for community projects, and we do bits of community work as well, like community meals and workshops and having community groups come in and use the garden.
Very nice. And it's really nice to be here in the height of summer. Last time I was here, it was the winter, and it's transformed so much. It's looking full of amazing produce, so it's great to see. I guess, could you say a little bit more about how the space came to be? And as you say, amongst tenements, and you wouldn't really know it was here. What was the history of the space? At what point did it transform into this amazing, luscious market garden?
Yeah, so this space has been used as a community garden for quite a long time. So previously, the local housing association used it as a community garden with raised beds for the local residents. And then eventually, I think they maybe got a bit overwhelmed with the amount of work that it was to keep it up. So they were looking for someone to take it on. And so Max, who is one of our co-directors and the founder of the Washhouse Garden, he took it on and turned it into the market garden that it is now. But yeah, I think it's quite typical of this local area. There's a lot of land that is just lying there, a lot of land that is just hidden behind houses and that is just derelict. We've got a site that is just opposite this one, the next block of flats over, which kind of mirrors this site, but yeah, it's looking a lot sadder. And I think we are very lucky that we were offered this bit of land and that we got to turn it into this, but there's so much more land in Glasgow that could be turned into something like this. So I hope that more projects like this can happen in the future.
The Washhouse Garden is one of very few market gardens in Glasgow at the moment, and particularly maybe in the East End, community gardens are a bit sparser than they might be in other areas. I guess there's so many benefits of, instead of just having a piece of derelict land that no one's doing anything with, or maybe there's some bins on or whatever, having a space like this instead. Maybe just to talk a bit more about some of the work you do, the community facing things, or I guess your veg box is quite a rare opportunity for people to get veg that's actually grown super locally.
Yeah, our business is kind of, there's two sides to it. So the veg box is our main stream of income. So this year we've taken a bit of a step back with it, and this year we're only doing between 20 and 30 veg boxes a week. Previously we've done up to 40, but because we wanted to focus a bit more on the community side of it this year, we've been working with a couple of local organizations. So Peak Possibilities for Each and Every Kid, they've taken on a bit of the garden with some of their youth groups. So they've been coming in during the school term time to do growing and cooking sessions with the kids. And then recently we started working with AMA Birth Companions, who support birthing people. And so similarly, they come in once a week and they harvest some of the produce, and then they cook over the fire and they have a big community lunch. Yeah, we want to do more of these things in the future as well, and kind of grow that side of the garden more, because even though it is really amazing to be able to do the veg boxes and to feed households with local food, I think having these cooking sessions in the garden is a really nice way to make the food that we grow more accessible to a wider variety of people, and people who maybe wouldn't necessarily go for a veg box or wouldn't maybe necessarily know how to use some of the produce that we grow. So yeah, hopefully more of that in the future.
And am I right in saying that what's going on just now is that you're packaging things up for your veg box?
We are just portioning up some tomatoes and some papalo, which is a South American herb. Yeah, and it's for a veg box. It's quite exciting that we've got tomatoes at the moment. It's always a bit of a highlight of the growing season for me.
They look amazing, lots of different colours and different sizes. They look very tasty indeed. And I do think that probably one of the limitations of audio is that people can't appreciate how amazing the garden look. If people do want to come on down and get involved, how can they do that? What are those kind of times that the garden is open for volunteers, and what would you say to anyone that's interested in getting involved?
Yeah, so we have our regular volunteer sessions every Monday 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. and every Thursday 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. and they're all drop-in sessions. So yeah, no expectations for anyone to stay for the whole day. Just come for as long as you want, and you don't need to have any gardening experience. We can teach you everything you need to know. And then we also sometimes do events at the garden and workshops. At the moment we do quite a lot of introduction to beekeeping workshops. So yeah, if you want to get involved, just have a look on our website, which is thewashhousegarden.co.uk, or we're also on Instagram and Facebook, and you can sign up to our newsletter as well to keep up to date with what we're up to.
Okay, fantastic, and I would highly recommend everyone who's listening to go and do that. Thank you so much for your time today, Jack, and yeah, I hope you have a lovely rest of your day on this Thursday, so you've got a whole day of volunteering and being in the garden. I hope you have a great time. So that was the first two stops on our Good Food tour of Glasgow's East End. So make sure you listen to part two to find out more about the other spots we checked out.